Hey, welcome in. This is All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast all the time. Here's what we're going to do, okay? A little different this time. I have some basketball thoughts about the NBA, and as I get back to playing, you know, does it hurt the Portland, does it hurt the Memphis Grizzlies? Yeah, but 3.5 games up with like 8 games to play, if you can't close the deal, you didn't deserve to be in the playoffs anyway. I don't love the fact that they're waiting 2 months. I think if you're going to play these preliminary games, you can play them earlier in July. I do think the product will be better because of the kind of ramp up to the playoffs that they're going to build. I wonder what the ratings will be like going up against football. But we all, I think most of us knew the NBA would eventually be back. It was just in what form or fashion. And, you know, look, it's going to be interesting. Maybe the reason they're delaying is because what they really want is to play in home arenas. And though they're setting up the bubble, there is the outside shot that conference finals, maybe NBA finals, get played in an arena if we pull out of the coronavirus quarantine better than expected. That said, who wouldn't be happy about basketball being back? But here's what I want to do this week. TJ Houshmandzadeh is my guest. He's a former Pro Bowl wide receiver with the Cincinnati Bengals. He's got an amazing story. We'll talk some basketball. We'll talk some protests. And we'll talk about the life of TJ Houshmandzadeh. Did you know he dealt drugs? Did you know he dropped out of high school? Did you know that when he's at Oregon State, they went 11-1 and kicked the crap out of Notre Dame? You're about to find out. Here's my guest, TJ Houshmandzadeh.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Let's welcome him in. He's the one, he's the only, TJ Houshmandzadeh. Hoosh, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Good, man. I want to ask you, I got a bunch of things to get to, and I want to try and allow you to tell your own kind of personal story, which I find to be one of the most fascinating ones in sports. But let's start with what everyone's talking about, which is these protests. And as we'll kind of detail as you tell your story, like, you weren't always on the right side of the law. You weren't always the father and former superstar NFL player you are today. When I say police, as a black man who grew up mostly in California, but in other parts of the country as well, how do you feel when you view people protesting the police and their treatment, specifically of African-Americans?
Oh, man, I can go to so many different layers when we talk that. And I can just speak from experience, number one. My brother, he got arrested when he was in the ninth grade. About 13, 14 years old. He got out when he was 23 or 24. First offense, had never been in trouble. A friend, and my brother got arrested for armed robbery. I had a friend get arrested for attempted murder. He's white Mexican, but he looks white. When they arrested my brother, they roughed his ass up. Roughed his ass up. My buddy gets arrested, they just walk him out the house. And this is attempted murder. They just walk him out. No roughing him up, nothing. Even to this day, I get pulled over, it's a problem. Like, I mean, the last time I got pulled over, and part of it was my fault, I didn't stop completely at the stop sign. My son was in the back seat. He said he used the bathroom. I literally was 500 feet from my house.
Right.
Get pulled over by the sheriff. And Larry walks up with his hand on his gun. I'm like, bro, I know I did that, but my son's in the backseat. He has to pee. Made a huge deal, called backup. They pulled guns, and I'm like, dude, what are you guys doing? Like, I live right here. What are you guys doing? And so it's a problem. It's a problem. It needs to be addressed. It's going to take time. But it's something that we as black men have dealt with forever, so you kind of get used to it. And it's sad that you get used to it because it happens on a regular basis for the most part.
Yeah. See, I always thought, and again, you know, like, our backgrounds are different. I've gotten in trouble before, you know, with the law. But I've always thought that the cop thing was a power trip thing, right? That you get the guy who, you know, the guy who becomes a cop. A lot of them are guys that they get to handle a gun. They get to be in charge. They get to be boss man, if you will. I never, because it's really hard to see yourself in somebody else's shoes, experience it through, you know, a black man's shoes, which I cannot. I always just, that's what I assumed. Has it changed? Has it evolved? You're saying it hasn't, right? It's still, this is now with you, with your son. It hasn't changed since you were a kid.
This happened probably about 3 weeks before the coronavirus, before the lockdown, the quarantine. Well, my daughter, she's a sophomore in college. She was a sophomore in high school. I'll never forget this, I was still driving her to school. And I would just get up, put a hoodie on, drop her off, come home. The same police officer pulled me over like 6 times in 2 weeks. Sheriff, not the sheriff. And the last time, I tell you, I was so angry. I went up to the sheriff's station. He kept pulling me over because he said I had window tint on my car. Well, when I go to the sheriff's station, the guy's like, oh, my son has window tint on his car. We all have. The sheriff pulls you over. He's being an a-hole for window tint. The same guy just kept pulling me over. The same guy. And I think he wanted me to go off on him, which I did. But I think he might have wanted me to take it a little further. I don't know.
I will tell you that when I moved to California the first time, I was working for CBS. I had an Audi and that I bought from a buddy of mine in Oklahoma. And it had tin, window tint on the front, and we kept getting pulled over for it. Finally, we took it off, and it was like one of those things. Like, what are you doing? I never really understood it. On the other hand, when I got pulled over, you know, they might not have been nice to me, but it wasn't like I felt unsafe, right? Like, there's a difference between everybody getting pulled over for the same thing and how it makes you feel. Right. And that's really kind of what it's about. It's the feeling of like, hey, man, you're acting as if you're harassing me and trying to hide behind the
exactly.
Windows.
Yes. Yes. It was like it really felt like a harassment. And it was like to the point where I was frustrated. And it was like the same guy, really, like, you recognize my car by now, bro. It's like pulling me over. It seems like every day. I thought it was ridiculous, and I went up to the, like I said, the sheriff's station, said something about it, and I didn't get pulled over again. What a coincidence!
I have had this thought, and I've shared it on the radio show, which is like, look, all of this, we're all sitting here saying, like, you know, Kaepernick had a point, right? Kaepernick and Eric Reed had a point, but my issue with Kaepernick is like, look, this is a movement where even cops are now taking a knee. That's the symbolic gesture that Colin Kaepernick took. I'm just wondering why he hasn't made himself into a visible leader of this portion of the movement.
You know, Doug, I don't think we, and when I say we as people, I don't think we can force our viewpoint onto Kaepernick, like you said, be a visible figure. He chooses to operate in the dark, so to speak, in the background. And for him, that's what he sees fit. And I think we got to get away from, because this is what we want somebody to do or be. That's not how he's going to operate. As long as he's trying to exact change, whether he's in the front or the background, he's still trying to get the same thing done. I think we got to get away from, you need to be in front. You need to be saying exactly this. He said what he was doing and what he was trying to get accomplished and the reasons why. Whether the front or the background, I believe it should have been enough, because we can't force anybody to be something that they're not. He probably didn't feel comfortable doing that. He probably didn't feel comfortable nailing it, but he felt he had an obligation to do it, and he did it. And so, because he hasn't been at the forefront, I don't see it as a problem, but I know plenty of people that do, and I don't understand why.
TJ Hushmanzada, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I've experienced basketball teams where there's guys that are supposed to be leaders that can't be leaders. I do think that's one of the things that haunted him when he was a quarterback, though, is that he's just not comfortable being that sort of visible leader, right? If you remember the first time he lost his job with the Niners, there was the talk of, well, he's quiet, he's got his headphones on all the time, he's not really a rah-rah, get-behind-us sort of guy. And I do think that is his personality, but it is part of what hurt him when he was with the Niners. Is that at least fair?
Yeah, that's a fair assumption because quarterbacks, you have to communicate, and there's times you got to, in essence, grab the bull by the horns and take over and be that extra coach on the field and just do things you may not be comfortable doing. And his personality can probably be as such. I'm just not 100% comfortable doing this or doing that. And that's okay. We, in the media now that I'm in the media, and even as a player, we always try to make our better players, especially our quarterbacks, the leaders of the team. Some of them don't have a personality, and they try to lead, and guys don't follow because they see that, they sense that, they feel that. And so, is that Kaepernick? I don't know Kaepernick very well. I've met him once. Very pleasant. The conversation flowed. It was very, I thought he was a cool dude. But when you start getting into this element, I don't know. And maybe he doesn't feel comfortable in the situation. Or maybe he just doesn't want all the attention on him. Who knows what it is. But he was ahead of his time with this. And what he did, it wasn't just police brutality. It's just been going on forever. And it doesn't happen all the time. But when it does happen, Black men are losing their lives. And that has to go. Obviously, to tell you, I don't have the best attitude when it comes to stuff like that. And that easily could be me because my temper will get the best of me. Man, I got four kids. Man, I can't have that going on because I lose my temper. And what you said, these guys are on a power. That has to stop, man. Like, it's a life. You get one life. When it's over, it's over. There's no do-overs. There's no going back. You can't plug yourself in a wall and reach, like, it's over, man. So, like, the beautiful part about being in California, and it's happened in California, is you grow up with so many different races, so many different people, that we learn to get along with everybody. Sports obviously teaches you that because there's so many different races. You come from different backgrounds. And so, but man, it has to stop. And again, with Kaepernick, yes, would you want to see him at the forefront? But I'm okay with you being in the background because you're trying to exact change. You're actually putting in your money, your sweat, your tears, your time. And so that has to say something. It has to mean a lot.
Yeah, I think the other issue, and obviously if you get stereotyped in terms of, I think this is the big issue, I believe, with cops, and this is where I would support them, is anytime you roll up to anybody's car nowadays, you have no idea who's packing. Right. Like part of that is I don't know what you talk about your attitude. Like, what would your attitude be like if you were a cop and anytime you roll up for a guy rolling a stop sign, you have no idea on that window you knock on what that guy has in his glove box. Right. Now, they're supposed to be trained and know how to deal with it and have better bedside manner. And I also think there's a good element to it to which, whether whoever you are, just because a Black man is the guy you're pulling over, that doesn't mean he's more likely to have a gun than anybody else, right? I'd love to see the stats that say that because I don't believe they exist, right? I think white guys are actually more likely to have a firearm, license or otherwise. But I think that's a big issue to it as well, which is like you don't know who's packing. And my attitude wouldn't be good if I have to knock on somebody's window and ask them to give me license registration, and I don't know what's going to happen when they roll down that window. On the other hand, it's how they deal with it. All right, let's get to your story, okay? Because it's one of the most fascinating things, and generally I reserve this pod. We talk about hoop, and I know you love hoop, and we'll talk about that some before we bid adieu. But you didn't finish high school. You become an NFL star. Like, how does that, your story is a movie. How does that happen?
A bit of luck. Maybe somebody going to hear this and they going to make a movie out of it. Who knows? I don't know. I don't know, man. It's crazy. Like, me and my buddies, like, my best friends, they've been my best friends since elementary. Majority since junior high, a couple since high school. These are the dudes that I'm still cool with to this day. I don't know. It just, growing up, mama was on drugs. She was a crackhead. Drank a lot on the 1st and the 15th, and anybody from the hood know what the 1st and 15th what those days represent. And so,
payday. It was just right, well, payday or government payday, whatever. Like that's when you when you have money. Well,
that's when you got welfare checks. Yeah, the 1st and the 15th. Yeah, and so the 1st and the 15th, we just knew we was gonna get a little money here and there, about $5-10, and the rest was gonna go to drugs and alcohol. And so that's just that was the way of life. Let's get back to the police really quick, Doug. When the police didn't come to our neighborhood, it was like a boring day. Like, I looked forward to the police coming to the neighborhood and all the dope boys running from the police. Like, that was exciting for me. When they didn't happen, it felt like, oh, today's boring. So that's how I grew up. Like, when they came to the neighborhood and all the dope boys started running, that was, as a kid, seeing that, it was excitement. And when that didn't happen, it was like, oh, today was boring. So that's another thing. But, yeah, my mom, she didn't emphasize school, man. My mom had 4 kids. And the youngest one is the only one of us to graduate. And so school wasn't emphasized. Nothing was really emphasized. We could kind of go as we please. I was in between my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother was a lot strict, very strict. And so obviously we didn't want to be there. We wanted to be with our mother because we got to do what we wanted to do. And so living with my mom, I just didn't go to school out of high school. I went probably 2.5 years total. Didn't play football until my senior year in high school. Grades came out. Obviously, I wasn't eligible, so I said, why am I going to school? I can't play sports. And, yeah, that was it, man. Walked on, went and played at JUCO. And once I got to JUCO, I had a really good first year. And the coach told me, you got a chance to play Division I. A lot of schools are going to recruit you. Go get your GED. So after my first year at JUCO, at Fritos College, I went and got my GED. And I buckled down in JUCO. I really did. I did well enough to get my AA. I like to always think, and I tell people this, I just didn't apply myself. I like to look at myself as an intelligent person. I just did not apply myself. And so when I decided to apply myself, school came rather easy for me.
Let me go back to when you were in, why were you in Oklahoma City?
My mom, I was living with my grandmother, and my mom met a guy, and he went to Oklahoma City, and we hopped on a Greyhound. I would probably say 6 months after she was there and moved to Oklahoma City.
How old were you?
I was probably 12 or 13.
So you get
That's
to Oklahoma
when I
City.
Really got into the streets, really was in Oklahoma City, believe it or not. I met a guy named Sean, and we started shooting dice, and shooting, we only had $20 each, and a dice game evolved into something completely else, and then that's when I got into the streets, and when I came back to California, I pretty much stayed in the streets.
Okay, wait, so you're using, I know what you're talking about, but as you're listening to this pod, we've had this conversation before. Okay, so you're shooting dice, and what happens? How does it evolve into something else? What's that mean?
It was just, you shoot dice, and again, we're just shooting dice for dollar bills. Anybody there, it goes back and forth. Nobody kind of gets an upper hand because nobody wants to bet enough money to lose their $20 extremely quick. And so, then when I say get in the streets, you go sell drugs. So we combined our money and was like, let's see how much we can do with this. And then eventually we kind of split up and went our separate ways, but stayed friends. And again, I was only in Oklahoma for about 8 months. And when I was in Oklahoma, I probably went to school, and that was the beginning and end, because I believe, so I wasn't 12, I was 13 going into my freshman year in high school. I didn't go to school in Oklahoma. I literally registered for school and probably went to school in 3 days.
You're not like selling anybody out now because it's 30 years later. You got $40. How do you go get enough money to sell? Like, how does it work to go get drugs and sell drugs? Like, how does that happen?
So it's very simple, man. So you call it a double up. Guys in the hood, you give them $40, they'll give you $80 worth of crack cocaine.
And so why do they give you $80 worth of cocaine crack if you only give them $40?
It's a double up. They try to help me get going. They basically helping me. And then okay,
so you go and you get $80. You sell it yourself? You and Sean sell it?
Yeah, me and Sean sell it ourselves. And I mean, literally sold in like 30 minutes. So we were like, oh my God, $80 this fast? So we went and got a 16th. Now, a 16th, when you cut up crack cocaine, if you cut it up well, a 16th can make you like $190, $200. So you go get a 16th and you do that. And then you split the money, you do it again, then you go your separate ways. Because now we both got $200 to $300. And now you can kind of get your own 16. The 16th back then went for $100. Man, that was years ago, obviously. And so, yeah, I mean, it was so many close encounters, man, like getting shot at, police coming to raid our spot. And here I am, 14 years old, moving around like I'm a grown man. And it just was so crazy. Like, but that was exciting for me. But looking back on it, like, I couldn't imagine my kids having to grow through that. But that was par for the course for me growing up. That was normal. I thought it was normal. I knew I didn't live great, but I didn't think I lived that bad until I met some friends that had some money. And you go to their house, and they're like, oh, my God, this dude got a mansion. And now I look back at that house, and I'm like, oh, it's a lavish house.
How did you know how to cut it?
I don't know. Just kind of learn. You see them cut it when they give it to you. And then you just kind of learn, you know, you just kind of learn. And then it just evolved as when I came back to California, I didn't really do as much crack. I just started selling weed.
Okay, so I want to get to that in a second. But okay, how'd you not get caught? Like, this seems like a...
I don't know. I don't know. I have no idea. I would always tell people, like, I'm just too smart. And I know that sounds like, yeah, that's what they all say. But I don't know why. Again, how did I make it to the league? I just got lucky. Somebody was watching over me. It was just meant for me to have these tribulations and not be affected. And, I mean, I was shot at, and people next to me are getting shot, and nothing happens to me. I mean, it was just a bit of luck, man, really, to be honest with you.
So when you moved back, you moved to Barstow, right?
Yeah, I moved to Barstow. My mother stayed in Oklahoma. We caught a Greyhound back to California, lived with my grandmother. My grandmother, very, very, very religious, Jehovah Witness her entire life. We come back to California, went to Barstow, friends, because I had, my mother would be between Barstow and L.A., but we would be with our grandmother, we'd be with our mother, we'd be back and forth. And so I had friends in Barstow. And so as soon as I got there, I was like, hey, bro, what's up? I need to buy this. We got to get in the streets. And so, like, they were my childhood friends. And so just started doing the same thing, minus the crack cocaine. It just went to weed. I was a little older, understood it a little more. But the crazy thing is, and I will say this, I've never done a drug in my life, man. I never smoked anything today in my life. I might drink once a year, and it could be because my mom do it so much, I would never do it.
So how did you get from, you were selling weed in Barstow, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get from, like, so how big did it get? Like, the biggest it got in Barstow was what?
I mean, I always had money. I will say that. I mean, like, I always had a nice chunk of change. I'm talking thousands, always. Always. I mean, I was doing all right, but I was never one of those big dope boys where, oh, I had this and that. I mean, I had a Cutlass Supreme, an 86 on some McLean's. I didn't even have Dayton's. But I always had a few $1,000s for sure.
During this entire time, you're growing up, okay? From SoCal to Oklahoma City to Barstow. Were you playing sports? Were you just hanging out shooting dice? What were you doing?
We obviously, growing up in our time, we would go to the park and play basketball. We would play football at the park, where you can't even use this term anymore, but when we called it, it was smear the queer.
Yeah.
You throw the ball up, the guy gets it, everybody goes, tackles him. We would play those type of games. I was always a sports fan, so I've always watched every sport. Huge fan of boxing, everybody knows that. Football, basketball, just got into baseball 6-7 years ago because of my kids, but I've always been a huge sports fan. And so I think mentally, just watching a game, I've always been a pretty good athlete. I was pretty much good at every sport, at least in my eyes I was, and I think that's part of the reason athletes are good, because you believe you are good. I went out to the football team. The coach, Coach Menares, Dionisio Menares, the Mexican dude, big dude, defensive lineman, he didn't take no shit. So he would yell at us. I would yell back. He'd be like, get the F out of here. And I would buck up to him, and he would buck up like, TJ, don't get your ass beat out here. And I wasn't used to that type of leadership, that voice, that you're not going to run over me, you're going to be disciplined, you're going to have some respect for yourself and your team. I just wasn't used to that. And so I couldn't play because we would clash all the time. I went off of practice 2 days. We get into it, I'm off the team. And then finally going into my senior year, I was like, if I want to play, I'm going to have to listen to Coach Menares just yell at me. And he yelled at me a few times. He seen that I kept coming back, and the rest is history. Kept playing.
Were you always a wide receiver?
No, I was a running back in high school. I was a running back in a DB in high school, and it was my choice to move to receiver when I went to Cerritos Junior College, because I always, just watching TV, I thought all the running backs were big. I thought they were all bigger than me, and as soon as I get to Cerritos, I'm like, oh, I'd be the biggest running back here. But I had already made my mind up that I was going to play receiver, and so go to Cerritos College, and I'm a receiver.
Wait, how'd you pick Cerritos College? Like Barstow, drop out of high school, how'd you decide, like, Cerritos is the place I want to go and play football?
So the head coach that I told you about, Dionisio Menares, he played at Cerritos. Left Cerritos, went to Nebraska. So when he played at Cerritos, he went and coached at Cerritos for a year. And my best friend, his name is Kush. And funny thing is, he don't smoke. That's just his nickname. I have no idea why his parents nicknamed him Kush, but you preface that he doesn't smoke. He was one of the top receivers in the state of California our senior year. He didn't qualify, so he went to Cerritos. What Coach Menares wanted him to come to Cerritos, and I'm like, we always together. There's no way you're going to Cerritos and I'm staying here. I'm going with you. So I went with Kush to Cerritos because they wanted him. I was just a tag-along friend that came along with Kush. Coach Menares was supposed to coach there, and that's why we went. He ended up taking a job at the University of Idaho. So we think we're going to go be playing for Coach Menares again. He leaves. He bounces. He's gone. And so it was just like, ah, here we go. And so, yeah, it worked out. I got lucky. Kush, I would say like a week before our first game at Cerritos College, he broke his foot. I was third string. Kush broke his foot. He was a starter. His backup, Lanye, I forget Lanye's last name, he got arrested. Oh, first game I started, first play of the game, I bombed somebody like 80 yards.
How amazing is that? Like somebody else gets, like all the shit you did and somebody else gets arrested, ends up allowing you to play and to ball out, right? Like it's like a halo that's around you. So Oregon State recruits you. Did Dennis Erickson recruit you himself? Was there a wide receivers coach? How'd you end up in Corvallis?
So coming out of JUCO, I was fairly highly recruited. I was probably a top three recruit in the country. Myself, as a kid named Delvon Flowers from El Camino that went to Arizona State. And I believe the other guy name was Eddie Williams. I believe he went to Arkansas. I believe that was his name. I could be wrong. But anyway, I was recruited. I was recruited by a lot of teams in the Pac-12, pretty much everybody. Minus UCLA, Stanford, but I was recruited by pretty much all the schools in the Pac-10 and now the Pac-12, some SEC schools, schools in the Big East. And so who recruited me at Oregon State was a guy named Mike Johnson. I believe he's at Penn State now. Mississippi State, but I don't know where he's at. Michael Johnson, he's the one who recruited me. His son's at Penn State. His son's a quarterback now. And so he was on the staff with Mike Riley. Mike Riley leaves and I believe goes to the Chargers. Erickson gets the job. keeps Mike Johnson on. So now it's Mike Johnson and Eric Yarber recruit me, who's not a receiver coach of the L.A. Rams. And so my JUCO coach, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. He was like, they just hired Dennis Erickson. They're going to throw the ball around, coming from Miami, blah, blah, blah. And so that's where I went. And crazy thing, it was like 15 of us from JUCO. We all took our recruiting trip at the same time. We were all JUCO All-Americans, and we all went to Oregon State and turned it around. And a handful of us, we ended up playing in the league.
By the way, Mike Johnson, that was his. He played for the Shreveport Pirates, the Orlando Predators, the British Columbia Lions, and the Canadian Football League. He was a JUCO guy himself, Arizona State to Mesa Community College. And then, you know, now he's, last year he was with, I believe, Mississippi State as their wide receiver coach. But but he was with the Niners as well. He's the Niners offensive coordinator 1 year, kind of ironically enough. Okay, so you get there. You get to Oregon State. The first time you met Chad Johnson was where and when?
I met Chad prior to getting to Oregon State. So our receiver coach, who's the one who started this footwork craze that everybody's doing now, Charles Collins, the OG, we call him Coach C. He coached at Santa Monica. That's where Chad went to JUCO at, him and Steve Smith. Eric Yarber, who's a L.A. guy, went to Crenshaw High School. Coach C went to Manual Arts. They were childhood friends. Yarbs introduces me to Coach C. Coach C, Coach Chad, trains Chad. And so we linked up that summer prior to we heading off to Oregon State.
What was he like?
Oh, and you know what's funny? Let me give you a story how Chad got to Oregon State. It's crazy how things work. We had a guy on our football team, a receiver named Mongero Jones, went to El Camino. He got kicked off the team for stealing somebody's DJ equipment. A scholarship came open. They gave it to Chad. That's how Chad got there. But Chad has always been, for me, Chad is a quiet dude, man. Real chill. Great dude. Like, Chad is one of the nice people you meet. Will give you the shirt off his back 1,000 times if you ask him 1,000 times. Probably too nice. But very quiet. And then you put a camera in his face or the competition gets going, and you're like, oh, my God, I thought he was quiet. And so, but initially, he's just real quiet, real chill, just working, trying to get better. Like, when I saw Chad, I was like, he was like the best receiver I had ever seen. The way he moved, it was like, whoa. But his personality, he was real chill until the competition started or a camera came around.
Did anybody at Oregon State, did they know about your upbringing, about your background? Like, did you ever tell anybody, like, hey, you know, I used to sell drugs up until, like, I decided to be a football player?
No, I don't. You know what? To be honest with you, probably yes and no. But in a lot of guys, and I don't want to say a lot, I don't want to assume, but that's like par for the course in our neighborhoods. Like, guys that you're going to sell some weed, you're going to sell some crack here and there, that's the only way to get money, you think. You see, because that's all you see. Like, the dope boys growing up, they got nice cars, they got all the pretty girls. You think, I want to be like so-and-so, D-Lo, when I grow up. And you see that. And so you think that's the way to go because you see nothing else. You don't see nobody getting up, going to work to be a doctor, going to work to be a lawyer, going towards law. You don't see that. At least I didn't. And so what you see, that's what we aspire to be. And so the guys at Oregon State, that the majority of them, story is very, very similar to mine. They just didn't play in the NFL. But everything else, it's very, very similar. So when you tell that story, when I tell my story, I'm telling the story of so many others minus the NFL because they've been through it already.
You guys went 11-1, right? You beat Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl. Your only loss was a 3-point loss at Washington. What do you remember more, the Washington loss or the Notre Dame win?
the Washington loss, because I remember like yesterday, our defense was, see, that's what people, we were so good defensively that if we weren't rolling on offense, our defense kept us in the game. But I'll never forget it. I believe UW hit us for over 250 rushing and 250 passing. Worst game our defense played all year. It was on the road. It was extremely loud. That's when they had Marcus Tuiasosofo as a quarterback. Willie Hurst as a running back. And we get the ball last. We drive the length of the field, and we miss the field goal to send it to overtime. The only kick, that field goal kick, I believe his name, is the missed
kick. Wait, what was the guy's name?
I believe it was Ryan Seska. I believe
your
that
kicker
was
Ryan Seska, correct. He made four extra points. Huh?
Was that the only kick he missed all year, I believe, huh?
Correct. He missed three field goals that year. He missed one extra point that year. Oh, no, wait. 2001? Yeah, you know, he missed a couple field goals. But he was a very good kicker. That was his sophomore year. He made 16 out of 19 field goals.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that like it was yesterday because, in essence, it prevented playing in the national championship because you know how they did it back then. I felt we were the best team. Our defensive linemen were running 4.5, 4.6. And offensively, we could throw, we could run. I mean, we could just do so much, but you know, it was always going to be the Florida State, the Miami, the Oklahomas that were always, we're unranked. We started at the bottom, and so it was, you lose that game to Washington, it was so hard to get picked to play in that national. At the time, we got picked to play in the Fiesta Bowl. They didn't even know who was going to get picked to play in that because Washington was going to the Rose Bowl because it was a three-way tie, and the Rose Bowl could pick who they wanted to play and that type of stuff between or the two-way tie between us and Washington because we beat Oregon in the Civil War. So it was just one of those things where I felt we had a really, really good team, best team in the country. But it's all talk. You never really get a chance to prove it, at least back then, not the way you do today.
I'm interested in that Notre Dame. Like, you guys show up, you got, what did you say, 15 JUCOs? 15 JUCOs.
Oh, at least.
Yeah, at least, right? Like, you, JUCO City, you guys have dudes for days. And you're at the Fiesta Bowl getting ready to play Notre Dame. And having gone to Notre Dame, I know that, like, Notre Dame, there's a level of confidence, arrogance, right? Like, you got the best of the best. I got to think at some point very early on the game, they must have figured out this was not a team that they really wanted any part of.
Early on, and I don't know if Coach Erickson was just trying to get us out for the game, but so you know how when you do bowl games, I don't know if it's similar in basketball because it's March Madness, things that you're playing so often, but for bowl games, you have a banquet, and initially we were told that the teams were going to intermingle. It'll be three guys from Notre Dame, three guys from Oregon State, and one coach at each table. That's initially what we were told. So we get to the banquet, and Coach Erickson's like, oh, they don't want to do that. They want Oregon State on this side, Notre Dame on this side. They don't want to intermingle. So, they think they're better than us. We're going to show these guys. And so we went into the game like it was like they really thought they were better than us. It's kind of what we're going through now. It's like they went to Notre Dame, this prestige school. Here we are at Olo, Oregon State. And I really think they thought they were better than us. And so watching their tape, it was like they're not going to do anything on our defense. And that's what made us good. It wasn't our offense. We were going to put points up, but our defense was so dominant because they were so fast. And it was just one of those things, like we're probably going to blow these guys out. Like literally guys had bets like who was going to get MVP. And nobody really played the second half because it was a blowout at halftime.
You know, it's interesting. At the time, did you know, I'm sure people told you stories, but like you didn't grow up playing football, and though you were a fan of sports, wasn't like you really, did you know traditionally how bad Oregon State was and how amazing what you guys were a part of was? I mean, you know?
Looking back on it now, yes, at the time, no. My first year there, I was pretty much injured the whole year. But that was the first winning season Oregon State had had in 30-plus years. And they made a huge deal about it. But any athlete will tell you, wherever we go, we think we're going to win. And so going to Oregon State, people are like, why are you going to Oregon State when you can go to USC? Why are you going to Oregon State when you can go here? I'm like, we're going to win. And that was just my mindset. If we all go here, all these guys that I played against in JUCO that I believe can really play.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, you guys outgained Notre Dame 446 to 155. They had 17 yards rushing.
And that was that, man. Like, our deep, like, we had just the, we probably had like seven dudes off that defense playing the NFL, maybe more. Dennis Weathersby, Terrell Roberts, may he rest in peace, DeLawrence Grant, DeJuan Edwards, Richard Siegler, Nick Barnett, James Allen. That's seven. And they know, too, like, we had, and I'm not talking about just playing a year or two, multiple years. And, like, we had a lot of guys from that defense. Ladarius Jackson, that's eight. Like, we had a lot of guys play a long time in the NFL that played on that defense. And so that's where our bread was buttered. We were very good and very fast on defense.
So you get drafted in the seventh round. What was it like leading up to the NFL draft in terms of your own personal expectations?
I was just training with Coach C. We just me, him, and Chad. That's it. Nobody else. Us three. Couple people would come here, come train with us every blue moon, but the workouts were so hard. It wasn't made for them. They couldn't take it. And so my expectations, you know, training, again, what did I say? I thought Chad was the best receiver I'd ever seen. So training with him every day, he's pushing me, I'm pushing him. He's making me better. Me pushing him is making him better, but me watching him is making me better. And so it was just us every day. Coach C is timing us in the 40. I'm like, oh, I really thought I was going to get drafted. Oh, I had been running extremely fast 40s. I've always been a good athlete. I was fast my entire life until I got to the NFL. And so I wasn't worried about the testing part of it. I just wanted an opportunity, especially when you see guys that are supposed to get drafted high come train with you and they can't do half the things you're doing. You're like, oh, I'm for sure going to get drafted high because I just trained with this guy. They got him as one of the top receivers in the draft. And you just don't know what you don't know. You think because you see this guy, you know how you move and you know how he moves, that it's going to pay off for you. And I was really naive to the whole process of how it worked. Pissed me off, but it is what it is. I mean, it still bothers me to this day, really. I'm not even going to lie to you.
Okay, what part of it makes you piss you off the most?
When I train with guys that were drafted, like if you look at the first round, I can name every receiver drafted in the first round. And only two of them, in my opinion, had solid careers. Really good careers, actually. I can't even say solid. Very good careers. And it was six receivers drafted in the first round my year. David Terrell, Corey Robinson, Rod Gardner, Santana Moss, Freddie Mitchell, Reggie Wayne. Only two of them had really good careers. Reggie Wayne had a great career. Santana Moss had a very good career. Those other four, and no disrespect to those guys, it did happen. And so, I mean, Steve Smith was drafted in the third round. He came out our year as well. And so it was just one of those things where, but a lot of it is my mindset, my work ethic. If you want something, you got to work to get it. You got to work. You just got to put the work in. And I'm just a firm believer in that. And so that's all I did was work.
You get drafted in the seventh round. How'd you make the team?
My mindset was this, was I remember this like it was yesterday, a first practice. And granted, I got into a fight my first practice in NFL minicamp. Got in a fight. I went out to that first practice, and people don't remember this. The Bengals drafted Peter Warrick with the fourth pick the year prior to myself and Chad getting drafted to the Bengals. And so, in my opinion, Peter Warrick and Reggie Bush are the two best college football players I've ever seen. So I was excited. I walk off the field the first day of practice, and I said to myself, got on the phone with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, oh, I'm making this team. I'm the best receiver on the team. I probably wasn't, but I damn sure thought I was after that first practice. And so I was not concerned, but I knew I had to work. But my mindset was, after that first practice, there's nobody better than me on this team at receiver. So I'm going to be fine. And I believe having that mindset, those positive thoughts, it helps a lot, a ton. And when I train my guys today, we train the physical, but we train the mental as well.
It took you, you had your first 2 years were okay. Your team was terrible. It was a mess. Your third year, you're injured, so you barely played. It wasn't until really your fourth year in the league that you made it, right? And so I know in your mind, like you had 41 catches your second year. I mean, that's pretty good. But to go all of a sudden
those
become a 70.
Those are time catches, though. Really, those are all we're getting our butts kicked. Let's throw TJ in the game. And so, you know, you get them all in the fourth quarter. Yeah.
Okay, so what changed?
Number one, I was healthy. I started doing yoga. Marvin Lewis and Hugh Jackson gave me an opportunity, which is all I wanted. Marvin's first year was my third year. Again, like you said, I was hurt, and he basically let me know, you can't be hurt again. He was always came at the club in the tub. And the biggest thing for me was I met a guy named Mark Blanchard, started doing yoga with him, and my health, I believe I was like one of the first guys in the NFL doing yoga. And I talked about it a ton because I didn't have any more muscle problems after that till the end of my career when I stopped doing yoga like an idiot. And so the yoga helped me. Peter Warwick had a slight fracture in his leg in the New York Jets game. He had to come out, miss some weeks, and I got an opportunity to play and never came out of the lineup.
We all know Carson Palmer's better than John Kitna. Okay, then John Kitna, obviously now, I think an offense coordinator with the Cowboys, right? Or no, a quarterback coach with the Cowboys. Okay, but for people who don't, like, okay, Carson Palmer, remember he sat your for the year you were hurt, he sat, he redshirted that first year. Mm-hmm. And then the year you blew up, it was with Carson Palmer, who started, I think, 13 of those games in his second year. What was it about you and Carson that allowed both of your careers to take off at that moment?
For me, it was opportunity, but it was the trust, Carson, that we developed. And it was initially unspoken. I think he saw that I really knew what I was doing, that I understood the offense, because we was the same offense. When Marvin came in, he kept Bob Okraski as the OC, and so the offense was the same. And our offense wasn't easy. It was complicated. The receivers had to know the protection. We had to know who they were IDing as the mic. We had to know who the back was blocking. If it was a mass protection, a scab protection, like we had to know all of this. And as a quarterback, when you know a receiver sees what you see, and if they're blitzing, I'm going to break hot. And if I don't, the quarterback's going to get hit in the back. He saw that I was breaking hot when I wasn't supposed to because it was Chad's responsibility. And people always, how did you go from this amount of catches to this amount of catches? Well, I saw they were blitzing, so I would break hot for Carson to give him an outlet. And he started to see that, and I wasn't even a hot guy. It was always the X receiver, which was Chad. We ended up changing it to me and Carson. We were just on the same page. We had that unspoken bond of we're seeing the game from the same set of eyes. And so it was, yeah, he just saw that early on. And he just started coming to me. It was times when he would say, if they give us this coverage, run this route. If they play this, run this route. We would just kind of make things up on the fly during the game. And he trusted that I was going to see what he was seeing. And it worked out.
You know what's amazing is, I don't know, you're part of the turnaround at Oregon State and then the turnaround with the Bengals. They were the Bungles before you guys got there. You get to the playoffs, right? This is like your fifth year in the NFL? You guys
fifth
get
year.
To the playoffs?
Yeah.
Right, Carson signs the biggest contract in the history of the sport, and then Kimo Van Olhoffen rolls up on his leg. What do you remember about it?
It was crazy because Carson and Chris Henry both got hurt on the same play. First play of the game, our OC, Coach Bratt, was going to attack him first play of the game. So they play a single high coverage, which Pittsburgh does, but normally their corners stay over the top. We're going to bomb him with Slim. Chris Henry, may he rest in peace. Carson threw a go out to Slim. Slim bombed him, caught the ball, and they both get hurt. Initially, you didn't realize it because you're so excited, the adrenaline, home playoff game. You don't, you know, he's down. You think he's going to come back in the game. Then you see him bring the cart out, and you're like, oh, my God. But we all have confidence in Kitna. Like, Kitna can play. People don't. We're winning that game at halftime. We're up. And so we still should have won the game. But if Carson doesn't get hurt, I truly believe we're the best team in the league. I believe we'd have won a Super Bowl because, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that's the year Pittsburgh went on to beat Seattle. Nobody could stop us. Like, if you play single high defense against us, and our offense, if you watch football, we talked about this. Our offense wasn't a gimmicky offense. We didn't stack guys. We didn't go in motion. We lined up. You played single high defense. For people that are listening, that's one safety in the middle, cover one or cover three. Me and Chad were going to kill you. And if you play too high, that's cover two or cover four, or some type of invert or two-man, whatever it may be, we would just run the ball. And we were good enough where we got open all the time in man coverage, and if you zoned us up, we were good enough up front with our offensive line that we could run the ball on you. And so it was like a pick-your-poison type of thing, and you could never be right because me and Chad could always get open, and for the most part, we could always run the ball.
If you could change one thing about your NFL career, what would it be?
Oh, just that I would have been on a team that could have won more. Towards the end of my career, I could have done more. For me personally, I wouldn't have talked as much. And it's more, when I say talk as much, I want to win so bad, and I'm so competitive that I think it, towards the end of my career, when I was in Seattle, like, I think I had a reputation of being like this bad locker room guy. When I can't, maybe I'm wrong. You go ask any team that I ever had, they all love me. At least I think they do. I've always been a team leader. Every team I've been on, guys congregate around my locker. I don't know why. They just did. Yeah. But I had a reputation, I think, in the circle of coaches that I wasn't good for a locker room or team. And part of that was my fault. Well, not part of it. All of it was my fault because I would go talk to coaches and I would challenge them, like, why are we doing this when they're doing this against us? Shouldn't we do this instead of that? And you can't challenge coaches. They're spending an enormous, crazy amount of time preparing a game plan. And here I am, this Rudy Poo-ass player, and I'm going to question your game plan? And I did that, and I shouldn't have done that. I was wrong for that. But at the time, it was my competitiveness. I'm just trying to win. They should be open to my ideas. And that just wasn't a good thing. I remember playing in Seattle. I told Matt Hasselbeck, man, let's go talk to Greg Knapp about what we're doing. And Matt Hasselbeck straight up told me, he was like, it's not going to change anything, TJ. I played long enough. They're not going to change it. So we just live with the game plan, and we try to execute it. And I didn't like that answer, but he was 100% correct. I'm like, let's see if we can get it changed instead of trying to live with it. And I went to try to get it changed, and I did that probably too much, and it was stupid of me. And you just live and learn. That's probably the thing that I would change. I would just be a player and try to be the best player that I can, and don't try to be a coach because I'm not spending the time they spend. That's where I went wrong.
Well, I don't even necessarily think it's that. Look, I learned that in broadcasting. You know, I learned that in broadcasting, and I learned that a little bit in coach. I didn't do enough. I thought I'm the opposite. When I was a player in college, I should have done more of it, you know, because I do think they respected my basketball IQ. I should have had more open conversations. But when you get to, like, in broadcasting, I have offered up my opinion, sometimes solicited, many times unsolicited, and it just never goes over well because guys that are in charge in TV, that's finally their chance to make a decision, and you're questioning it, even if you have. Like you said, like, look, your intentions are, I just want to win football games. It's not necessarily about me. And when you're doing in terms of doing TV stuff, it's not all about you. I'll give you an example. Okay. So I was doing I did the NBA draft on radio for a decade. And about, I don't know, halfway through, maybe 7 years in, I went to the guy who originally had hired me and I said, hey, can I have an idea. Or I sent maybe an email. Like, here's an idea. You guys, and even in the email, I shouldn't have sent probably an email, but I don't know why that matters, but it does matter. And you know who Ryan Russillo is, right?
Yes.
Okay. So Russillo at the time wasn't who he is now. He was a guy who covered the Celtics. He was a fill-in guy. He loved hoop, and he watched more hoop than even I did. Okay, I don't. That doesn't necessarily mean he broke it down the way I did, but he knew people in the league. He did all the work, whatever. So I said, look, you hire like three or four guys to do the NBA draft, and they're all great guys. Okay, but college guys don't know the pro game, and pro guys don't know the college guys, right? So it's a flawed premise to have all these guys commenting on players they don't know, or teams that they don't know, or the league that they don't know. What if you just had me and Russillo do the NBA? We both are professional radio guys. We both know the sport. We both know college. We both know pro. We both talk to people. We can break stories, and we can both interview. I was like, and oh yeah, by the way, I'm already on a contract. Doesn't cost me a penny. I'm already on the show. Doesn't change anything. I'm not saying fire anybody. I'm just saying, like, look, instead of hiring three people, just you already have Russillo. Pay him a day rate, and there you go. And the response that I met with, then I was taken off the draft for like 2 months. And then, like, I had to go to one of the bosses, like, this is crazy. And it turns out it's because my boss at the time was like, who the fuck are you trying to tell us what we should do? And I was like, look, man, I was already on the draft. I was just trying to help him be a better, but that's the way shit happens. Okay. Carson Palmer or Joe Flacco, Matt Hasselbeck?
Oh, that's easy. It's Carson. Wait. Carson was, and he was one of the better quarterbacks to ever play in the NFL. He'll never get that acknowledgement. He'll never get that because we didn't win enough. Carson was big. He was a fantastic athlete that people didn't realize he was a great athlete because he sat in the pocket. But if he wanted to move around, he had the athleticism to move around if he wanted to. Great arm. Tremendous person. Like, Carson was so, like, the entire team loved Carson because he exuded just I'm one of the guys type attitude, and guys gravitated to him. Yeah. And he didn't have to force you to. It was just natural for him. Like, we would have parties, team parties, and Carson comes to everyone. You don't, A9, you coming? You don't even have, you know he's coming. And so he did what you want quarterbacks to do, and it came natural for him. And it could be because he was a quarterback his entire life. It was ingrained in him. He knew what to do. I don't know, but, oh, yeah, it's not even close. Not even close, in my opinion. And that's no disrespect to Hasselbeck and Flacco. But, again, I spent a lot of time with Carson. I was only with each of those guys 1 year.
Last thing, okay? I mean, because no background is more different than you and Carson Palmer, right? Like, he grows up South Orange County, private school, superstar high school, college, Heisman, number one pick, right? Like, no, but your story, I mean, look, you had, I mean, Cedric Benson's passed away, obviously. Chris Henry passed away. Like, you have... The story of you guys with the Bengals was there's a lot of chances taken there. If I'm whether it's basketball, football, coach, executive, whatever, how do I determine when I look at your back? Because you and I have gotten to know each other for 15 years now, right? How do I, like, part of it is, like, we do this background check and we find out who, and they're like, whoa, you didn't graduate high school? You know, wait, what? He was doing what? And there are people that will not give you that shot because of your life as a kid and your upbringing, which has nothing to do with you.
Racism. Really, just be honest. That's what it is.
I don't know if it is racism, though. I think there's socioeconomic.
Right. And because of my socioeconomic background is the reason why I don't know if I would want to give them a chance. But if I come from a low-income neighborhood, or if I come from a middle-class or high-end neighborhood, why should it matter? You sit
because I think the concern
you
is
you meet with a guy.
Yeah,
at least you can tell if a guy is genuine. You can tell if a guy is trying to run game on you, as we say. You see right through that. You see right, like, bro, you're not hustling me. You see, at least I can. And so for me, it was just a part of my childhood. And again, and I've had people tell me once I started to play, yeah, I thought you were a thug. Like, we weren't going to even take a chance on you. Like, had scouts and coaches tell me that.
Yeah.
Once I established myself, I'm like, wow, really? And I get it. I get it. Your job's on the line. Nobody wants to lose their job over one guy, and if you're wrong, I mean, I get it. But how do you handle that? You would hope the meetings and just getting to know a guy, but again, they only do that for the top 30 or 40, 50 guys, man. Other than that, I don't believe it matters to them.
Well, I mean, but I would say, like, you know, the where could it go wrong is the Chris Henry thing, right? I mean, like, look, Chris Henry had all this off-the-field stuff that took away from the fact that he was a spectacular talent on the field, right? You have kind of the three levels to it. Like, you know, Chad, who is really, as you point out, a quiet dude, but when the camera's on, you know, he has no problem, you know, kind of turning it up. And he had some off-the-field stuff, which probably caused the early termination to his career. You had nothing, right? And then you had Chris Henry, which obviously, you know, he tragically dies. And I think that's the fear, right? The fear is that a guy with what would be called a questionable background goes the Chris Henry route, as opposed to what happens to you, where you become kind of synonymous with, like, this is what you want a pro to be. And that's a hard thing to determine if you're a general manager. And I'm just wondering, when you're trying to assess and evaluate who somebody really is, take away the background, you think, like, just meeting with the dude is the way to do it?
I mean, it's tough. You can meet with a guy. You don't have a lot of time. You can have phone conversations. I don't know if you can ever make this an exact science to where, I got this one nailed. I just don't believe that's the case. And again, my situation, to be honest, it was luck. Like, I didn't play sports growing up. I don't graduate from high school. I played my senior year. Like, I don't know how I made it, really, to be. I just worked hard as hell. I worked harder than everybody. And people that train with me, they know this. But it has to be more to it than that. Yeah. I'm just lucky that it worked out for me. And there's so many cases like mine that aren't lucky. It doesn't work out for them. I'm very aware of that. I'm very thankful, because where would I be? What would I be doing? Consider my mother had four kids and only one of us graduated, the youngest one. None of them had done anything in life to the point where, as a parent, you'd say, that's my son or that's my daughter, because school wasn't emphasized. It was being the streets or whatever. Like, it wasn't emphasized in our family. That's all I do with my kids. They probably like, shut up, TJ. Like, hey, come on, you gotta do this homework. You better get 100 on this. You better get A. Like, that's all I do is emphasize school to my kids. And if you're gonna play sports, you're just gonna have a lot of work to do, because we gonna study and we gonna work at your game. But yeah, there's no exact science to this. It's a feel for it, understanding people if they're trying to game you, and hope you make the right decision, really, to be honest with you. Because when you say it like that, there's really no way, Doug, to figure out who's the right guy and who isn't, from a mental perspective, from a social perspective, and we're not even talking getting on the field and playing football or the court playing basketball.
Last thing, Jordan or LeBron?
Oh, man. Do I really have to answer that?
You can say whatever you want to say. You don't have to. You don't have to pick.
Me personally, for my generation, it's easy, Michael Jordan. No question. But if I look at it now, I didn't like the Bulls. I was a Laker fan, so I hated Michael Jordan, because it seemed like he never missed. But when you look at it now, like, this generation, they're going to say LeBron. LeBron scores. He rebounds. He passes the ball. Oh, damn, how old is LeBron? Like, LeBron is playing at a high level every single year of his career. And so, to answer that question, if I had be honest and impartial, I truly would say LeBron, to be honest with you. Just because every team, when LeBron leaves the Cleveland Cavaliers, what happens? They're in the lottery. LeBron leaves the Miami Heat, what happens? I don't know if they're in the lottery. If they made the playoffs, they're eliminated in the first round. He leaves the Cavs again. Oh, they're in the lottery. Michael Jordan left the Bulls. They still made the playoffs. And so LeBron means so much to a team. Looking at it impartially, I would probably say overall basketball player, LeBron, scorer, Michael Jordan, even though LeBron scoring-wise is close.
The best defensive back you ever faced. Who is the guy?
Champ Bailey. Owned you?
What made him so good?
Bailey, but then because Champ was big, and he was quick, and he was fast, and he didn't talk no shit. Like, you couldn't even get Champ to talk shit to you. But I'm gonna give you a name. I'll give you two names that never get credit, and me personally, I thought they were good. Maybe they just gave me a hard time. I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
Lee Bodden. You never heard of him, huh?
I've heard of Lee Bodden.
Lee Bodden, a dog, straight up to play. Big, fast, physical. Lee Bodden could play. And then I'll give you two more. Ike Taylor was pretty good in Pittsburgh. I thought he was good. Never got a lot of credit. He's a guy that talked shit. He talked it right back. Like, it can go on all game. And I actually thought Courtney Finnegan was pretty good, man. Smaller guy, feisty, had to compete. But God, those three, but Champ Bailey, he was the best DB that I played against, but tons of respect for Lee Bodden and Ike Taylor for sure.
All right, you're a major shit talker, so that means you have to step up here. Who's the guy who gets lots of respect and people talk about how good he was and he really wasn't very good? To you.
At what position?
The guy you matched up with, cornerback.
Oh, what quarterback do they think? The
corner.
People
corner,
think good?
Corner.
Oh,
corner.
DB.
DB.
Oh, man. That's a tough one. Give me a DB that people think is good. What's good?
Well, I mean, I guess you got to go like in your, like Lee Bodden was in your division, right, with Cleveland, right?
Oh, he was good, but honestly, Doug, this is no lie, man. We didn't go in motion. Me and Chad were like, we got open. We ran routes.
No, I understand.
All those names I named, we still killed them.
No, dude, I got you. I got you. I'm just saying.
I'm trying to. Think of any corners in our division because Baltimore had Chris McAllister, Gary Baxter. We killed them. The Steelers probably did the best against us, but we killed them. And the Browns, yeah, we killed them. I'm trying to think. No, I mean, because we played the Raiders. I'll never forget it. We played the Raiders. Marvin Lewis was talking trash to me and Chad the whole week. That's when they had Nnamdi Asomugha.
Yeah.
And little fast dude, what's his name? Fast dude went to Nebraska. He's from Florida. Like Bradenton or Pensacola. I can't even think of his name. Brownskin dude. I can't think of his name right now. But all they did was play man-to-man. Me and Chad had 100 yards at halftime. Got 100 yards at halftime, both of us.
Why didn't Chad work in New England?
They're locking him up.
Why didn't Chad work in New England? Why didn't that work?
We had been in the same system forever. I think going to New England might have been a shock for him. Chad played X from the time he got drafted to the Bengals to the time he left. Then going to New England, it was just different. And it's well documented. I helped Chad a ton in Cincinnati. And so if there was any question on what he was to run, I just told him. And so he got used to that. Chad is my partner. Like, I love that dude like a brother. And so Oregon State, Cincinnati, anytime we're on the field and he looked like he didn't know what he was doing, I just told him, no second thoughts. I want to win. You're one of the best receivers I've ever seen in my life. You can help us win. I'm going to help you because you're my brother. And so it could be it was just a little much for him. The comfort level, it was different. You're in a marriage for 10 years and you get used to doing things a certain way. You get a new girlfriend and things change. You got to get adjusted to it. Football, there's no adjustment. You got to adjust now or else you don't play. And so it would have to be the system. It wasn't, for sure, wasn't physical.
Yeah, no, he lined up in the wrong spot. He struggled to, you know, Brady and him didn't, you know, he was also a guy who kind of went by feel, and that's not how they play there, right? They didn't deviate from whatever the deal
Chad
was.
Chad is so gifted, man. It's like he's like a basketball player. Oh, you want to run this play? No, give me the ball, clear out. Yep. And he would improvise on his route. He would run the right route, but it would be a lot of improvisation going into it. And the quarterback, you know, he wants to see if I got a dig route, you're going to get up the field, break 18 yards. I want the ball to be caught before the hash, 2 to 4 yards outside of the numbers or inside of the numbers. And Chad is going to do that, but it's everything before that that the quarterback and the OC probably don't like. But creating separation, he can do that. But yeah, it sucked because Chad is one of the best receivers to ever play football, and he'll never get that credit. No question. Anybody, no question, is talent wise, it ain't close, bro. I've seen them all. It ain't close.
Hoosh, great stuff, man. I appreciate what you're doing in the sports world, you know, in teaching and coaching wide receivers as well. Teaching guys that, you know, about work ethic and your own children about going to school. Thanks so much for joining us, and I can't wait for somebody to make a movie on your story.
Hey, Doug, I appreciate you, brother. Take care. See you tomorrow, man.
Perfect. Hoosh, I got to run. Thanks, dude.
Take care.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
All right, that's TJ Hoshmandzadeh. I still disagree with him on Jordan and LeBron. And I do think that the younger generation likes LeBron because they've seen LeBron and they've maybe forgotten how dominant Jordan was. But, you know, I think especially after The Last Dance, I'm even more of a Jordan guy. That said, it's great perspective. Hey, I hope you enjoyed that interview. A little bit different, not a ton of basketball. But as we've done on this podcast, we tell people's kind of life tale of how they got to where they are now. Hope you enjoyed it. Remember to download, to subscribe, and to rate it, because I think somebody gets more money. I don't, if you do so. In the meantime, listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you download podcasts, wherever you listen to terrestrial radio like Fox Sports Radio. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.